Palm Sunday, of course, is the beginning of our Easter week, and over the course of today and then next Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, we'll also be celebrating and attuning ourselves to many aspects of this very holy season. People think more about Christmas than about Easter, but the power of the Spirit is especially manifest during this time, and we really encourage all of you to take the time both to participate and to attune yourself. You'll find the blessings are beyond what you expect, beyond imagination of expectancies, Master's words. In the story of the life of Jesus, there's always been a mystery, or at least a mystery to some people, which is the fact that the Bible refers to Jesus at the age of 12, and then there's no reference to him at all until he returns at the age of 30, and then there's 3 years of his ministry. These are often referred to as the lost years of Jesus. They, of course, weren't lost. They were just lost from the record. Jesus himself lived through them, and the likelihood is that everybody around him knew what was happening. And in fact, now that we're coming into a higher age of understanding, many, many stories are coming forward about what happened to Jesus during those so-called lost years. Paramahansa Yogananda states unequivocally that Jesus went to the East, he went to India, he went to Tibet, he studied with the great masters there, and then when he was ready, he came back to the people for whom he had been born, which was the Jews in that part of the world, whose sincere longing for a deeper understanding of truth had caused him to incarnate in the first place. A master comes because the prayer of love went up from earth and you responded, which our Festival of Light, which we will be repeating a little later in this service, is a recounting of the continuous descent of self-realized masters to help us out of the wilderness of our own misunderstandings. Now, Jesus' departure for the East around the age of 12 is very interesting, because what is written in the Bible is that Jesus, it was the Passover season again, and it was the custom of devout Jews at that time, practicing Jews, to go into Jerusalem to celebrate the holiday in the big temple there. So Jesus was part of a caravan of people of his own people, including his parents, but by implication, extended family and friends, and the way life was at that time, a child belonged to the whole community as much as to his two parents, because you infer that from what happened next, which is they all went to Jerusalem, they celebrated the Passover, and then Jesus' parents left, Joseph and Mary, and they were 3 days or so out from Jerusalem before they noticed that Jesus wasn't with them. So we assume he wasn't in the back seat of their cart, or else they would have noticed it until that time. The obvious assumption was that he was with some other family, some other aspect of the family. But then they figured out that he wasn't anywhere. And rather frantically, as you can imagine, the parents rushed back to try to find him. And where they found him was in the Jerusalem temple, sitting in the hall of learning, and he was listening, and he was also preaching. He was 12 years old, and he was sitting there, and he was telling the others about their own teaching, and he was offering wisdom sufficient for people really to be listening. Now, Jesus obviously then was fine. He had not been lost at all. He had merely chosen to do something else. His parents, however, were extremely relieved to see that he was well. And he found the fact even that they had come back for him bewildering. And his answer was, "Don't you know I must be about my father's business?" Meaning, I didn't come here to be your son. I came here to serve my heavenly father, and now I've begun my mission. Why would that even surprise you? And why would it occur to you to come and get me? Now, there's a lot implied here that is other than Jesus, the darling little child of Joseph and Mary, just growing up as this little innocent in the cabinet shop there. You know, there's a whole lot of implied truths about who Jesus was, why he was born, what kind of consciousness he had even from a young age. Now, Master goes on with this story, and this is by no means the popular myth at all, not the way it's presented, that Jesus went back with his family at that point. But shortly thereafter, they started instigating plans, Master actually said, to marry him, to get him a wife and a family. And he would have none of it. He was not born for this comfortable life of like this nice integration of a few spiritual ideas with everything else that we want, which is how some people try to think about spirituality. Spirituality is I get to have everything, including and above all my ego and all its preferences, which is better than not having God at all. It's better than just having the ego. But nonetheless, it's not really why the masters incarnate from a life of infinite joy and freedom in God, just as Swamiji said, to change the flavor of the soup a little bit. They come to give us something completely other. Now, Master also told us at the Christmas story that the three wise men who came to visit Jesus, he said, were three of the masters who are pictured on this altar, Lahiri, Babaji, and Sri Yukteswar. Now, he offered that to help those of us who follow this path to understand, and a very important reason, not just to sort of get credibility for those masters because of their association with Jesus, but rather to show that the path of self-realization, the path of Christianity, the path of the so-called masters of the East, is all one journey. That each of these masters, even though distinct in himself and offering a particular aspect of the divine ray, nonetheless, we're not in competition with each other. That it isn't about who can get the most disciples, and that if we want love one, we must necessarily hate and feel the others are in some way not worthy of our veneration. But rather, all paths lead to the same truth, and the masters just give us different ways to walk. So Jesus, Yogananda tells us, left his home because he'd had enough of his home. He'd had enough of ordinary life and other people's ideas of who he was supposed to be. And he head out to the East to repay the visit of those masters. Now, the obvious implication here is that they were going to be in this lifetime his teachers and his gurus. Because an avatar, even though he comes with a fully self-realized consciousness, also comes as an example to us to show us how to be born into this world and live a life that leads not merely to another one just like it, but that leads to the path of actual God realization. So even Paramhansa Yogananda, who was fully self-realized from birth, acted out the drama of deep longing for God, of intense spiritual practice, of the desire for a teacher, of finding a guru, of becoming a disciple, of being disciplined by his master. And it was what they call the lila, the divine play that he acted out. Because otherwise what happens is all his disciples would say, well, you all have to do spiritual practices. You all have to long for God, but we don't. On our path, we just sit around and are self-realized. Now, when Jesus went to study and to become what he later manifested in his mission, it wasn't exactly that he had to learn, but it behooves us to act out. Even when he came to let John the Baptist baptize him, and John, perceiving his glory to be, you know, making baptism unnecessary, Jesus simply said, it is righteous that we do this, even though it is not what it seems from the outside. This is righteousness, that you should baptize me, that I should humble myself before you. And the song that we sang at the beginning of Palm Sunday was the voice of God that came forth after Jesus was baptized. This is my son. And there was those who had the ears to hear, heard this powerful affirmation of who this man was. Return now to begin his mission. Now, his disciples, Jesus would have had no reason not to tell him where he'd been. The taking out of those years in the life of Jesus came later, by ignorant priests and prelates and institutional religion, and when Christianity started becoming churchianity, as Yogananda describes it, the priests were wanting to have things a certain way. And they decided that it wouldn't make Jesus look good if he had had to go somewhere and study. So we want him to make him, above all, look good. And by that time, we're trying to say that he's the best and the only. And if he's the best and the only, then there can't be anybody else. And he couldn't have done sadhana. He just must have sprung full grown exactly as he is. And all the confusion of theology has followed from that. Because we stepped away from the truth of self-realization, from the gradual expansion of consciousness, of the individual expression of God, until it becomes the Christ. The most astonishing thing about Jesus is that he earned that because of his dedicated determination, self-discipline, lifetime after lifetime. He came to the state of divine realization. He became the Christ, the anointed of God. And continually, in his own words, he was always telling everyone around him, "That which I do, ye shall do. And you call me master, but I call you friend. And you know, be therefore perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. And you descended from heaven, even as I did." The difference only is that he was aware and we were not aware. So when he came back to begin his public mission, but the priests decided that that just didn't fit in with what had begun to be their less conscious understanding of his teachings, and gradually then true spirituality, the idea of self-realization, which is the unifying principle of all teachings of all masters, becomes religion. And once I have one, then I can't have the other. And once this is mine, then I don't like yours. And then once this is mine, I'm justified in doing all these things. And all the mess that we see around us is the result. The return of the principle of self-realization through this line of gurus is the beginning of bringing all that back into a unified whole. So we have two amazing trends going on this planet right now. We have the die-hard fundamentalists who are trying to make everybody else die hard too, right? And then we have this blazing light of new understanding that's coming. And some of that blazing light is illuminating truth, which is a devotion to God, a recognition of the power of the masters, the dedication to personal practice, and some of it is just illuminating the idea, let's just throw the whole thing out, ego is enough. So really you have three trends going on. Fortunately, this is Dwapara Yuga rising. This is a new age of new consciousness, so apparently the good guys will win this time. Good guys meaning us, of course. But really, the unifying principle of self-realization, for which we are named, but we certainly don't own it. So, coming back to Jesus. So Jesus comes back. And who knows how many of his disciples were with him in India, how many disciples he brought back from India. All of these details now have been obliterated. They're probably recorded somewhere, and maybe as the generations and the age rises, all of this information will be discovered again. But in any case, here he is. And he ends up having only 3 more years of life, which is really a very short period of time. So he lands with a lot of force. And he's here now, and he has one mission now. He needs to plant in the place and time to which he has come, in the hearts and minds and souls of those who are receptive to him, this new understanding. And this is a refinement, or I should say a restoration. The teachers, the avatars, the masters, as they come age to age to age, and in India there's a much longer tradition, so they speak of it, they don't come to destroy anything. But they come to restore. They come to bring things back into line. If destruction takes place, it's only because old wineskins can't accept new wine. And when the new force is put into them, it may crack under the strain of the new reality. But when Jesus was asked many times, "Have you come to destroy?" "No, I've come to fulfill." Yogananda, even when he was asked, "Did you bring a new religion?" He said, "No, I brought a new expression." Because things get distorted. And at the time that Jesus was born, the distortion was that from Moses' true revelation, which had been articulated in terms of divine law, which is a stage of understanding that the people at the time he came needed, they needed to see in clear-cut terms, this is what the divine asks of us, this is what we must do. It's an obvious need of the human heart to know where I stand and what's asked of me. But law can be offered with love and mercy. Or law can be offered heartlessly and for the personal advantage of those expressing it. And what happened to the true revelation of Moses is it became a religion. And by the time Jesus incarnated to that same tribe, because the Jews were the only folks around at that time who were thinking in terms of self-realization or in terms of these higher, truer teachings. The others were worshiping, they were pagan. And that's not merely that they're worshiping images of God, but they were trying to get aggrandizement from many different places and sources. They didn't understand the overarching truth. The Jewish people still did. That's why Jesus incarnated for them. But he needed to straighten it out. And by that point, the people who had power from the wrong teaching were just simply not about to relinquish it. It's just as simple as that. People who have power are not likely to give it up. I remember when communism disappeared, this man in our congregation at that time had escaped from communist Bulgaria. And he had, this was many years ago, and he had to come out in a very dangerous way. And there was sort of this belief at the time that the communist leaders had just decided, oh, I made a mistake, let's be nice from now on. And I remember him standing up in our congregation. I do not know what the context was. It must have been a class. He stood up with so much power in his face. He said, I know those people. They would never give up their power like that. You know, just don't be naive. So Jesus comes, and all these people have power. They have egoic power. They have wealthy power. They have social power. And Jesus says, I bring a message from our Father, which is going to take it all apart. Huh, what chance is there of that? You know, and that was the correction that he had to make. That instead of being true, humble servants of the one God, there to enlighten and to help others, it had become, this is a pretty good way for me to have power and position. Swamiji said something interesting not too long ago. He said there was too much abuse of power among leaders of the various churches. He said that's why those positions are not that much respected these days. Interesting, just a karmic correction. Here's an interesting other side I've noticed. Vast majority of clergy people of all denominations these days are women. It's like the male energy has moved out of that field. The women are moving in, and I think it's probably the beginning of a restoration. I'm not a feminist. I think men and women are just like two sides of the same coin. Isn't that a novel thought? And we're a lot more like each other than we are like pretty much anything else around here, you know? So I don't think one is inherently good and inherently the other. But it's interesting that there's been this, when you go through lists and lists of churches, there's all these women in positions of leadership. And I think it's just a necessary corrective. You know, we sort of need to bring it back not that women are immune from these things, to be less about outward force and more about inner attunement. And, you know, some women are going to be better at that than men. Some men are going to be better at that than women. But it'll work itself out. This is a very big story. We're born for these little tiny pictures, and we think we've got the whole thing all figured out, and we're just, you know, like little ants, just sort of, you know, staring at something and thinking we can see the whole view. So Jesus comes back at this time to make this correction. And from the beginning, you know, incarnations are different. Jesus was an extraordinarily powerful individual. It's one of the reasons many of us really like the picture of Jesus that we now have in the center of the altar up here. Because this looks like a man with power. Some people don't like it for that very reason. They want perhaps a softer or a sweeter or a different. But this man had power. This man came to transform a society that, well, even in the Old Testament, the Jews called themselves, even in the New Testament, they refer to themselves as a stiff-necked people. I was born into the Jewish culture. I grew up in it. I know it. Yes, that's all I'll say. You know, it's a lot of force there. Force can be misused. Force can be used for good. It's just energy. Depends how you use it. So Jesus really had a battle on his hands. This was not just a sort of let's just float in and I say, oh, by the way, I think I'd like to dismantle everything that you're depending upon right now. Not a chance. You know, the money changers had invaded the house of the Lord. Just one scene tells you who this man was. With a whip in his hand, he drove those people out. You know, imagine somebody sort of, we have a little book table out here and somebody comes in with a whip and drives us out, you know. You know, it's a moment to remember. And this is not like a sweet, like lovely guy. This is somebody with force that you can hardly begin to imagine. And whatever force he was exerting with that stick in his hand, even more of it was coming out from him. Because why didn't they stop him? You know, there were more of them than him. But his power was there. So Jesus is beginning his mission, and he's having to build up his magnetism, not his personal magnetism, but the magnetism of his mission, draw people to him. He walks, he sees his disciples, they see him. This power is beginning to build. And those disciples who come to him have the intuitive understanding to realize who they are with, at least on some level. And you can imagine that they had many, many deep and extraordinary experiences with him. You know, in the course of the spiritual life that we've been living here at Ananda, many of us for many years, you know, there are moments of just absolute transcendent experience in which you know that you are somewhere else, that the masters are with you, that reality has completely shifted, and a certainty on a level that mere reason can't create comes into you. Last night we had a Kriya initiation here, and that was one of those moments. And we stepped outside of the ordinary dream and stepped into a greater reality. So undoubtedly, Jesus' disciples have been having this experience. Undoubtedly, Jesus is telling him why he is there, telling them why he is here, why he is there, and what he is doing. And they, in their own hearts, had been longing for him, even if they hadn't been able to form the exact words or understanding. As we say in the Festival of Light, a prayer of love went up from earth and you responded. So all of this is happening there, but they don't know where it's going. I know, even just in the little life that I've had with Swami Kriyananda here, I remember in 1971 when Ananda was, you know, one piece of land, just, you know, 100 acres of land, and a little bit else that we got somewhere else. We were living literally in school buses and huts that we made out of stapling plastic to 2x4s and hammering big sheets of plywood together and teepees. And we loved it. No indoor plumbing, no electricity, and no prospect of ever having any. I mean, it was bliss as far as we were concerned. And I remember Swami just sitting there casually talking about, yes, after we develop a number of communities on the West Coast, then we'll work on the East Coast, and then from there we'll go to Europe, and after Europe we'll go to Australia, and then when Australia is established, we'll go to India. India would rather be part of an international organization. And, you know, we're sitting on the porch of this little dome, hoping the next time it rains that the room doesn't flood. And, you know, eating the kale out of the garden and the Jerusalem artichokes and wondering when we'll ever be able to afford to go to the dentist again. And he's just telling us these things so casually. In fact, Swamiji said later, he stopped talking about the future of Ananda. I mean, that even that I would be living in this city, you know, in this dress, in this room, absolutely beyond imagination of expectancy in 1971. Swami Kriyananda himself said, I stopped talking about the future of Ananda because I saw it didn't inspire people, it just frightened them. So you can imagine what Jesus didn't say. But at the same time, they knew who they were with. They knew what the power was here. And they were an oppressed people. They were oppressed by the priests, but they were also oppressed by the Romans. And the Jews, there was this tradition that somebody was going to come and rescue them. And it would be the Messiah, and he would become their king. And everybody understands in their own way, you know. And many of them thought that the Jewish people would be restored to glory and to freedom and to everything that they knew in their hearts that they should have. And that some thought this man was going to do it, and some thought this man wasn't going to do it, and some thought maybe this man would do it, and some thought let's wait and see whether this man will do it. But there was this huge thing going on so many different levels. And many different times, Jesus came right up against the edge of conflict with the real power of his society, but always he pulled back. And then it came to this Passover, and Jesus knew it was the end of his life. Maybe a few others had the intuition to know, but he wasn't announcing it. But what happened was he had resurrected Lazarus from the dead. And, you know, it's one thing to sort of say this man does miracles. It's another thing because many of the people had seen Lazarus dead. And then Lazarus was not dead. This is really hard to dispute. In fact, there's a line in the Bible which I just love. One of the priests says to another, we're going to have to kill Lazarus too. You know, because as long as Lazarus is walking around, it's going to be hard to discredit this guy. Very, very human when you think of it like that. So then this day comes, and everybody's going to Jerusalem for the Passover, and they're all talking to each other. They didn't have the internet, but they talked, right? Do you think he'll come? Do you think he'll come? Have you seen him? Did you hear about Lazarus? I saw Lazarus. I was there. You know, just like this. And then he comes. But he doesn't only just walk in. He decides that he will unleash the power that is within him. You see, that's what made Palm Sunday what it was. Jesus would open up that power, and then he would pull it back in. And then he would open it up, and then he would pull it back in. But on this day, not only did he allow it to happen, but he orchestrated it. You see how conscious? This is not just happening. This is the power of God and the wisdom of God acting itself out for the sake of disciples forever. And he orchestrates it. Go and get that donkey and bring it to me and put a blanket over its back and I will ride upon it, because the later they will know why I did that. Your king comes to you riding on a donkey in humility. But then he starts coming in. And he allows the power that is in him to come out of him. The masters have control over this. Sri Ramakrishna at a certain point started glowing. He had this golden light around him. Ramakrishna was a master in the 1800s in India. And because of this golden light, people started coming. But he wasn't ready to have that. And this is how he tells it. Ramakrishna was such a child in his spirit. He went up on the roof and he said, back inside, like that. Because it wasn't time yet for that to happen. You know, they have complete control over this. They say that, you know, Master sometimes, how did they put it? You know, sometimes Master would manifest miraculous occurrences, and then other times he would just pull his energy back in and just pass as an ordinary citizen. So Jesus allowed his power to show because he knew what was coming. He knew this was going to be the end. So his disciples are with him, and the ones who really know him are around him. But the others have all heard of him, and the closer and closer he gets, the more this power spontaneously affects everyone, and they begin to take off their coats and lay them down in front of him. Why would they do that? Because they felt something was happening that had to be honored. They strip the leaves off the tree and lay them down so that the donkey's not walking on the dirt, but on this pathway created by the spontaneous devotion of the people. What a moment. I mean, what a moment. And one of the priests then says, "This is so inappropriate. Don't do this." And Jesus responds, "If I silence them, the very rocks would cry out," which is creation is simply celebrating the presence of its source. And Jesus didn't say, "I," but he didn't have to, because that's where the power was emanating from. And oh, imagine. Everybody, just what does this mean? And the disciples, their exhilaration, their upliftment, their expectation. But who dreamed of the tragedy soon to befall? Within a week, he was arrested and crucified. Astonishing, isn't it? Now, I'm sort of running out of time, so I'm almost going to have to say stay tuned and see what happens. But I'll try to bring it to a little bit of an end here. Our lives so often are really just living on the waves of the ocean, and the wave goes up and the wave goes down. You know, we have this false idea in our mind that our spiritual path is this triumph over everything, and then everything is comfortable and good after that. That's basically what I'm sure Jesus' disciples couldn't help but think. Now, finally, what we've known to be true is going to happen. And Jesus allowed that power to come through him, but its purpose was so different. Its purpose was to lead into, yes, his death, but his death was for his resurrection. Because everything in our lives is going someplace that's so different than we think it's going. We define it so much according to our ego desires. Now I'm rich. Now I have my relationship. Now I have the respect. Now I have the youth. You know, apparently there's this movie which I haven't seen. I don't know if I would see. Margaret Thatcher now has Alzheimer's. I'm not speaking of her as an individual, but yes, of course. Because it's not upward into the world. We don't push the wave to the top and then get to stay there. You know, the wave goes up And for a time, God asks of us to do outward things, wonderful, glorious, powerful things, Margaret Thatcher. And then all of a sudden, oh my goodness, look, there's a whole nother reality that also has to be met here. And insofar as we define ourselves by those upward and downward moving ways, we are always at the mercy of change. I remember one of the earliest things I heard Swamiji say, change is the only certainty in life. Most people do not like change. That's why most people suffer. But Jesus absolutely was beyond the power of change to affect him. He rides gloriously into Jerusalem. He's hideously tortured and humiliated. He dies on the cross. And he's resurrected in light. That is the story. God bless you.